This episode of the OrthoBullets podcast will go over the topic of ACL tear from the knee and sports section on orthobullets.com. Let's start this episode with a quick summary. ACL tears are common athletic injuries leading to anterior and lateral rotatory instability of the knee. Diagnosis can be suspected clinically with the presence of a traumatic knee effusion with increased laxity on Lachman's test, but requires MRI studies to confirm the diagnosis. Treatment involves ligamentous reconstruction utilizing a variety of techniques and graft choices depending on patient age and activity levels. Now, let's get into the episode. With respect to epidemiology, as far as incidence, ACL tears are common, and there are approximately 400,000 ACL reconstructions per year, and ACL tears account for half of all knee injuries. As far as demographics, ACL tears are more common among female athletes. Females sustain ACL injuries at a younger age than males, females get more ACL injuries on the supporting leg, and males get more ACL injuries on the kicking leg. As far as risk factors for ACL tears, female participation in soccer and male participation in basketball are both risk factors for ACL tears. In addition, a valgus moment at the knee and adduction moment at the hip upon landing is also a risk factor for an ACL tear. Now, let's talk about the etiology of ACL tears. With respect to pathophysiology, the pathoanatomy involves a non-contact pivoting injury, where the tibia translates anteriorly while the knee is in slight flexion and valgus. The pathoanatomy also involves a blow to the lateral aspect of the knee, and know that common activities that can result in an ACL tear are soccer, basketball, skiing, and football. Again, to reiterate, there's a preponderance of ACL tears for females due to landing biomechanics and neuromuscular activation patterns, as they are quadriceps dominant, which are the factors that play the biggest role. As far as associated conditions with ACL tears, the ones to know include meniscal tears. Specifically, remember that lateral meniscus tears are seen in 54% of acute ACL tears. However, you can see medial meniscal tears in chronic cases. Other associated conditions include PCL injuries, as well as LCL / posterolateral corner injuries. Know that chronic ACL deficient knees are associated with chondral injuries, as well as complex, unrepairable meniscal tears. Now, let's talk about some relevant anatomy. So the ACL has two bundles measuring a combined 32 millimeters in length by 7 to 12 millimeters in width. The bundles are named for the tibial attachment. So know that the anteromedial bundle is more isometric, is tightest in flexion, and is primarily responsible for restraining anterior tibial translation. This is what you are testing in the anterior drawer test. The posterolateral bundle has greater length changes, is tightest in extension, and is primarily responsible for rotational stability. This is what you're testing in the pivot shift test. As far as the femoral attachment, the lateral intercondylar ridge demarcates the anterior edge of the ACL. The bifurcate ridge separates the anteromedial and posterolateral bundle attachments. The tibial attachment is the anterior tibia between the intercondylar eminences. As far as the composition of the ACL, it is 90% type 1 collagen and 10% type 3 collagen. The blood supply to the ACL is the middle geniculate artery. The innervation is the posterior articular nerve, which is a branch of the tibial nerve. And as far as biomechanics and function, the ACL provides 85% of the stability to prevent anterior translation of the tibia relative to the femur. It also acts as a secondary restraint to tibial rotation and varus/valgus rotation. And finally, know that the ACL has 2,200 newtons of strength with anterior force. Now, let's talk about the presentation of ACL tears. Patients will typically have a history of feeling a pop, pain deep in the knee, as well as immediate swelling in 70% of patients, as well as hemarthrosis. Symptoms include generalized knee pain, feelings of instability preventing return to sport, and difficulty weight bearing. On physical exam, inspection may reveal effusion, as well as a quadriceps avoidance gait, in which the patient does not actively extend the knee. In terms of motion assessment, these patients will have a lack of full extension secondary to a meniscal injury or arthrofibrosis, and know that you can evaluate for meniscal or concomitant ligamentous injuries with the McMurray, Dahl test, as well as a varus/valgus stress test. Neurovascular examination will evaluate perineal function following high-energy mechanisms and suspicion for multiligamentous injury patterns. Provocative tests to know include the Lachman's test, a pivot shift test, and a KT-1000. The Lachman's test is the most sensitive exam test, and in terms of grading, A equals a firm endpoint, while B equals no endpoint. A grade 1 injury will have 3 to 5 millimeters of translation, grade 2A/B will have 5 to 10 millimeters of translation, and grade 3A/B will have greater than 10 millimeters of translation. A PCL tear may give what's known as a, quote, false Lachman due to posterior subluxation. Moving on to the pivot shift, in this test, the knee is brought from extension, or anteriorly subluxated, to flexion or reduced with valgus and internal rotation of the tibia. Note that the knee reduces at 20 to 30 degrees of flexion due to IT band tension. It's also important to remember that the patient must be completely relaxed and therefore a pivot shift is easier to elicit under anesthesia. Remember that the pivot shift test mimics the actual giving way event, which we discussed earlier in the pathoanatomy section. Finally, a KT1000 is useful to quantify anterior laxity and is measured with the knee in slight flexion and externally rotated 10 to 30 degrees. Moving on to imaging, recommended views on radiographs include an AP, lateral, sunrise slash merchant slash skyline view. Findings are often normal. However, you may see what's known as a Sagan fracture, which is an avulsion fracture of the proximal lateral tibia, which is pathognomonic for an ACL tear. This represents bony avulsion by the anterolateral ligament, or ALL, and this is associated with an ACL tear 75 to 100% of the time. Another potential finding is the deep sulcus or terminalis sign, which is a depression on the lateral femoral condyle at the terminal sulcus, which is a junction between the weight-bearing tibial articular surface and the patellar articular surface of the femoral condyle. Moving on to an MRI, this is indicated to confirm the clinical diagnosis of ACL rupture and evaluate for concomitant pathology. In terms of findings of a torn ACL, there will be discontinuity of the ACL fibers on T2. Remember that the normal ACL fibers appear steeper than the intercondylar roof and in continuity of fibers all the way from the tibia to the femur. The sagittal view on MRI may also reveal an abnormal orientation, which is described as too flat compared with the intercondylar roof slash Blumensatz line. This acute angle is common in chronic cases where the ACL scars to the PCL. Remember that on sagittal view, there may be non-visualization of the ACL. Other findings of a torn ACL on the sagittal view include bone bruising in greater than half of all acute ACL tears. You will see this in the middle one-third of the lateral femoral condyle, otherwise known as the sulcus terminalis, the posterior one-third of the lateral tibial plateau, and know that subchondral changes on MRI can persist years after injury and may contribute to long-term chondral damage. Finally, also keep in mind that you may see a tibial spine avulsion fracture on the sagittal view of the MRI. In terms of the coronal view, you may see discontinuity of ACL fibers, which do not reach the femur. You may also see fluid against the lateral wall, which is known as the empty notch sign. As far as sensitivity and specificity, MRI has 97% and 100% respectively. A CT scan can be indicated in revision settings to evaluate for bone loss. As far as sensitivity and specificity, this is the most sensitive and specific test for bone loss associated with osteolysis and tunnel widening. Moving on to treatment of ACL tears, treatment is individualized to the patient based on activity level, age, demands, and concomitant pathology. There are non-operative and operative options. Non-operative options include physical therapy and lifestyle modifications. This is indicated in low-demand patients with decreased laxity, as well as a recreational athlete not participating in cutting/pivoting activities. In terms of outcomes of non-operative management, there are increased meniscal/cartilage damage is linked to loss of meniscal integrity, the frequency of buckling episodes, and level 1 and level 2 activity, for example, jumping, cutting, side-to-side sports, and heavy manual labor. Operative options include ACL reconstruction, ACL repair, and ACL revision reconstruction. So as far as indications for ACL reconstruction, these patients must have full motion of the knee restored following the injury, unless there's a meniscal tear causing a mechanical block. Lack of preoperative motion is a risk factor for postoperative arthrofibrosis. Other indications for ACL reconstruction include younger, more active patients, as reconstruction reduces the incidence of meniscal or chondral injury. Other indications include children, as activity limitation is not realistic. Older active patients, and remember that age greater than 40 is not a contraindication if this is a high-demand athlete. Partial slash single bundle tears with clinical and functional instability. And finally, another indication is prior ACL reconstruction failure. In terms of outcomes, return to play is largely influenced by psychological, demographic, and functional outcomes. Moving on to ACL repair, this was previously abandoned, but there has been increased interest recently in the pediatric populations and in avulsion rupture patterns. As far as outcomes, again, ACL repair was previously abandoned due to high failure rates. However, the arthroscopic bridge-enhanced ACL repair, or BEAR trial, with a bridging scaffold is ongoing, and 2-year results show comparable results. Finally, moving on to ACL revision reconstruction. This is indicated in the setting of failure of prior ACL reconstruction with instability during desired activities. As far as concurrent pathology, let's go over MCL injury, meniscal tears, chondral injuries, and posterolateral corner injuries, as well as high tibial osteotomy or distal femoral osteotomy. So starting with MCL injury, if there's a low-grade MCL injury, this is amenable to non-operative treatment, and you can allow the MCL to heal prior to ACL reconstruction. However, if there's a high-grade MCL injury necessitating repair / reconstruction, this may be done concurrently with the ACL. In terms of outcomes, failure to address valgus instability can jeopardize the ACL graft with higher re-rupture rates. Moving on to meniscal tears, remember you can perform the meniscal repair or meniscectomy at the time of ACL reconstruction. And in terms of outcomes, know that there are increased meniscal healing rates when repaired at the same time as the ACL. Moving on to chondral injuries, partial or full thickness chondral injury may be treated at the time of ACL reconstruction in a staged fashion if the injury necessitates. As far as outcomes, presence of chondral defects consistently lowers long-term patient-reported outcomes following ACL reconstruction. Moving on to posterior cruciate ligament and posterolateral corner injuries, you may reconstruct these concurrently with ACL reconstruction or as a staged procedure. In terms of outcomes, failure to recognize and address posterior cruciate ligament and posterolateral corner injuries will lead to varus instability and ACL graft overload. Finally, moving on to high tibial osteotomy or distal femoral osteotomy, know that limb malalignment in both the coronal and sagittal plane must be addressed before or at the same time as ligament reconstruction. Remember that lateral closing wedge osteotomy is more effective at addressing posterior tibial slope than medial opening wedge osteotomy. As far as outcomes, there are high ACL failure rates in unaddressed limb malalignment. Now, let's talk about some of these management techniques in a bit more detail. So starting with physical therapy and lifestyle modification, as far as the technique, early symptomatic treatment is followed by 3 months of supervised physical therapy. Physical therapy focuses on range of motion and progressing to quad, hamstring, hip abductor, and core strengthening. There should also be reevaluation at the conclusion to assess progress, and know that functional braces demonstrate no added functional stability. Moving on to ACL reconstruction, the goal is to anatomically reconstruct the ligament to restore anterior and rotational stability. The approach is arthroscopic assisted. The technique involves clearing out the remnant ACL fibers to visualize the native bony landmarks. In cases of single bundle ACL tears, there is no difference whether there's removal of the remnant ACL or removing all fibers prior to reconstruction. Also know that there are no patient-reported differences between single or double bundle reconstructions. However, single bundle is the most common, while double bundle may better restore native knee kinematics with less laxity. In terms of femoral tunnel placement, these may be drilled transtibial or independent of the tibia, that is, an inside-out or outside-in. Proper placement in the sagittal plane is a 1 to 2 millimeter rim of bone between the tunnel and the posterior cortex of the femur. In the coronal plane, the tunnel should be placed on the lateral wall at 2 o'clock for a left knee or 10 o'clock for the right knee. This creates a more horizontal graft and reduces rotational laxity. The anteromedial and far medial drilling portals may enhance the ability to achieve these tunnel locations. There is no difference in clinical outcomes between transtibial and anteromedial drilling techniques. It's important to remember that drilling the tunnel in over 70 degrees of flexion will prevent posterior wall blowout. Moving on to tibial tunnel placement, in terms of proper placement in the sagittal plane, the center of the tunnel entrance into the joint should be 10 to 11 millimeters in front of the anterior border of the PCL insertion, 6 millimeters anterior to the median eminence, and 9 millimeters posterior to the intermeniscal ligament. In the coronal plane, there should be a tunnel trajectory of less than 75 degrees from the horizontal. You can obtain this by moving the tibial starting point halfway between the tibial tubercle and the posterior medial edge of the tibia. As far as graft placement, graft preconditioning can reduce stress relaxation up to 50%. Note that graft tensioning at 20 newtons or 40 newtons had no clinical outcome effects in a level 1 study. Be sure to fix the graft in 20 to 30 degrees of flexion. As far as graft fixation, there are various options for graft fixation dictated by graft selection and surgeon preference. Know that this can be used alone, for example, an all-inside suspensory fixation, or in combination, for example, interference screw with a screw and washer post. Remember that interference screws provide aperture/compression fixation, while cortical buttons, screw and washer posts, and staples all provide suspensory fixation. Now let's talk about revision ACL reconstruction. And approach considerations include the cause of the prior ACL failure, concomitant pathology, prior graft selection, and careful assessment of the underlying cause of re-rupture. In terms of the technique, you will use a high-strength graft like a quad tendon, hamstring, or allograft. You may also use dual or backup fixation, such as suspension plus interference screws. You can also use bone grafting and reconstruction in cases of previous tunnel dilation of 15 millimeters or if interfering with anatomic tunnel creation. The addition of an anterolateral ligament or ALL reconstruction, that is a lateral extraarticular tenodesis, is controversial. Finally, remember that reharvesting a bone patellar tendon bone is contraindicated. Postoperatively, revision ACL reconstruction patients will be prescribed conservative rehab. Now let's talk about graft selection in a bit more detail. We'll go over bone patellar tendon bone autograft, quadrupled hamstring autograft, quadriceps tendon autograft, and allograft. So starting with bone patellar tendon bone autograft, the advantages of all autografts is using a patient's own tissue. These are the most common sources of graft. They have faster incorporation, less immune reaction, and no chance of acquiring someone else's infection. As far as pros and cons of bone patella bone, this has the longest history of use and is considered the gold standard. Another advantage is bone-to-bone healing leads to faster incorporation time. You will have the ability to rigidly fix the joint line with screws. However, this option has the highest incidence of anterior knee pain, up to 10 to 30%, as well as kneeling pain. The maximum load to failure for a bone patellar tendon bone autograft is 2,600 newtons. Remember that the intact ACL is 1,725 newtons. Complications of a bone patellar tendon bone autograft is patella fracture, which is usually post-op during rehab. Another potential complication is patellar tendon rupture. Re-rupture is another complication and is associated with patients less than age 20 years of age and a graft size of less than 8 millimeters. Moving on to a quadrupled hamstring autograft, as far as the technique, this may be taken from the contralateral side in a revision situation when an allograft is not desirable or available. As far as pros and cons, this will have a smaller incision, less perioperative pain, and less anterior knee pain. The maximum load to failure of a quadrupled hamstring autograft is approximately 4,000 newtons. However, keep in mind that these patients will have decreased peak flexion strength at 3 years compared to bone patellar tendon bone autograft. Also remember that there is a concern about hamstring weakness in female athletes leading to increased risk of re-rupture. Some complications to be aware of in the setting of a quadrupled hamstring autograft include what's known as the windshield wiper effect, in which suspensory fixation away from the joint line causes tunnel abrasion and expansion with flexion slash extension of the knee. Other complications include residual hamstring weakness, as well as paresthesias due to injury to the saphenous nerve branches during harvest. Keep in mind that an oblique or horizontal incision lessens this risk. Now let's go over quadriceps tendon autografts. So as far as pros and cons, this involves a small incision in an area that does not see pressure during kneeling. It does not involve the physis. The maximum load to failure is 2,185 newtons. Quadriceps tendon autografts will have a similar patient-reported and functional outcomes as other autografts. You may include bone block or completely soft tissue. It's also less commonly used, so is often available in the revision setting, and know that it has the same disadvantages as hamstring autograft with suspensory fixation. Finally, moving on to allograft, as far as pros and cons, these are useful in revisions. There's no harvest site morbidity. However, there's a longer incorporation time. It's more expensive than autograft, and there's a risk of disease transmission. For example, HIV is less than 1 in 1.6 million. However, hepatitis is even greater. Another con is that an allograft has an increased risk of re-rupture in young athletes. The odds of graft re-rupture are 4.3 times higher in allograft for athletes aged 10 to 19. As far as graft processing, fresh frozen grafts lower re-rupture rates compared with chemically treated or irradiated grafts. Know that supercritical carbon dioxide decreases the structural and mechanical properties. In terms of radiation, greater than 3 MRADs is required to kill HIV. However, this decreases the structural and mechanical properties. 2 to 2.8 MRADs decreases the stiffness by 30%. 1 to 1.2 MRADs decreases the stiffness by 20%. Deep freezing destroys cells but does not affect the strength of the graft. And finally, 4% chlorhexidine gluconate destroys cells but does not affect the strength of the graft. Now let's talk about some pediatric considerations. So in terms of the physis, patients less than 14 years old will typically have an open physis. And know that the onset of menarche is the best determinant of skeletal maturity in females. As far as treatment of ACL tears in pediatric patients, non-operative indications include compliant, low-demand patients with no additional intra-articular pathologies. It's also indicated in partial ACL tears, as 60% of adolescents have partial tears, but they must have near normal Lachman and pivot shift tests. Surgery is indicated in the setting of a complete ACL tear. As far as surgical techniques in pediatric patients, there are intra-articular strategies, combined intra- and extra-articular strategies that are typically used in males less than or equal to 12 years old and females less than or equal to 11 years old, and adult-type reconstructions, which are typically done in males greater than or equal to 16 years old and females greater than or equal to 14 years old. So intra-articular techniques include physis sparing, or all intra-epiphyseal, transphyseal, which are done in males less than or equal to 13 to 16 and females less than or equal to 12 to 14, partial transphyseal, which can leave either the distal femoral or proximal tibial physis undisturbed, and know that there are no significant differences in growth disturbances between techniques. As far as combined intra- and extra-articular techniques, which are again used in males less than or equal to 12 and females less than or equal to 11, an autogenous iliotibial band is harvested free proximally and left attached distally to Gerty's tubercle. This is then looped through the knee in an over-the-top position. This is then passed through the notch and under the intermeniscal ligament anteriorly and sutured to the lateral femoral condyle and proximal tibia. As far as graft selection, transphyseal soft tissue grafts rarely lead to growth disturbances. In terms of instrumentation, factors found to increase physeal injury include large tunnel diameter, defined as greater than 12 millimeters, and this is the most important. Know that an 8 millimeter tunnel corresponds to less than 3% physeal cross-sectional area, and a 12 millimeter tunnel corresponds to greater than 7 to 9% of physeal cross-sectional area being violated. Other factors found to increase physeal injury include oblique tunnel position, interference screw fixation, high-speed tunnel reaming, lateral extra-articular tenodesis, dissection close to the perichondral ring of LaCroix, and suturing near the tibial tubercle. The main complications to be aware about in pediatric patients is physeal disruption without growth disturbance, which occurs in 10% of patients. Now let's talk about rehabilitation after ACL surgery. Immediately, you will start aggressive cryotherapy, that is with ice. Immediate weight bearing has been shown to reduce patellofemoral pain. You will emphasize early full passive extension, especially if associated with an MCL injury or patella dislocation, and know that there are no long-term differences found between accelerated and non-accelerated protocols. Early rehab will focus on exercises that do not place excess stress on the graft. As far as appropriate rehab, eccentric strengthening at 3 weeks has been shown to result in increased quadriceps volume and strength. You can do isometric hamstring contractions at any angle, isometric quadriceps or simultaneous quadriceps and hamstring contraction. Active knee motion should be between 35 degrees and 90 degrees of flexion. There should be core and gluteal strengthening incorporated throughout therapy. And finally, emphasize closed chain exercises, that is, exercises with the foot planted, for example, squats or leg press. Be sure to avoid isokinetic quadriceps strengthening at 15 to 30 degrees during early rehab, as well as open chain quadriceps strengthening, for example, leg extensions, which mimic an anterior drawer and Lachman maneuvers. As far as return to play, there is no widely accepted criteria supporting clearance or timing to return to sport. The previously held consensus is no sooner than 9 months following surgery. And remember that the patient should pass a series of functional tests that replicate sport-specific activities. That is, various single and double leg hopping and jumping. Know that dynamic valgus has been shown to increase the risk of ipsilateral and contralateral rupture. And know that there have been higher rates of re-rupture following early return to sport prior to clearance. Clearance for return to play should be made between the surgeon and the patient. Psychological factors play a large role in timing of return and should not be overlooked. In terms of injury prevention, let's talk about the female athlete, skier training, and ACL bracing. So in the female athlete, injury prevention includes neuromuscular training / plyometrics, that is jump training, landing from jumping in less valgus and more knee flexion, and increasing hamstring strength to decrease quadriceps dominance ratio. As far as injury prevention in the setting of skier training, this teaches skiers how to fall. And as far as ACL bracing, there is no proven efficacy except for ACL deficient skiers. Finally, let's end this review session talking about some complications of ACL tears. So in terms of intraoperative complications, the ones to know include graft tunnel mismatch and posterior wall blowout. So in the setting of a graft tunnel mismatch, a bone patellar tendon bone graft total length that is greater than the combined length of the femoral tunnel, tibial tunnel, and intraarticular distance connecting them leads to a prominent tibial bone plug and inadequate fixation. Risk factors include a bone patella tendon bone allograft, patella alta, and non-transtibial drilling techniques. Treatment is precise intraoperative measuring of the tunnels and the graft, as well as twisting the graft tendon on itself to effectively shorten the graft length. Moving on to posterior wall blowout, this means cortical breach of the posterolateral cortical wall of the lateral femoral condyle. Risk factors include inadequate exposure of the posterior wall prior to drilling, failure to evaluate the tunnel walls after drilling, and drilling the femoral tunnel while the knee is flexed less than 70 to 90 degrees. Treatment: if there's a minimal defect at the notch opening of 3 to 5 millimeters, you can re-drill the tunnel, deviating anteriorly and proceeding with the prior intended fixation method. If there's a substantial cortical defect, keep the previous tunnel, but the graft fixed with suspensory fixation, that is a screw and washer post, cortical button or staple, and or interference screw fixation. Interference screw fixation may be added to supplement a suspensory device. Moving on to graft failure due to tunnel malposition, the incidence of graft failure for any cause approximates 5%. Graft failure due to tunnel malposition is the most common cause of ACL failure, attributed to 70% of failures. Moving on to femoral tunnel malposition, let's talk about malposition in the coronal plane and the sagittal plane. So in the coronal plane, vertical femoral tunnel placement is caused by starting the femoral tunnel at the vertical position in the notch that is 12 o'clock, as opposed to the lateral wall that is 10 o'clock. This will cause continual rotational instability, which can be identified on physical exam by a positive pivot shift. In the sagittal plane, anterior tunnel placement leads to a knee that is tight in flexion and loose in extension. This occurs from a failure to clear what's known as residence ridge. Posterior misplacement, also known as over the top, leads to a knee that is lax in flexion and tight in extension. Moving on to tibial tunnel malposition, in the sagittal plane, anterior misplacement leads to a knee that is tight in flexion with roof impingement and extension. And with posterior misplacement, this leads to an ACL that will impinge with the PCL. Now let's talk about graft failure due to other causes. So inadequate graft fixation or hardware failure can be caused by graft screw divergence of greater than 30 degrees. Attritional graft failure is when the graft is less than 8 millimeters in width. An intra-articular femoral bone plug dislodgement requires revision surgery. Graft failure can also be due to a misdiagnosis of concomitant ligamentous injuries, that is, in combined ACL and posterolateral corner injuries, failure to treat the posterolateral corner will overload the graft and lead to failure. Finally, overaggressive or improper rehab, like open chain exercises, can be another potential cause of graft failure. Moving on to infection and septic arthritis, the incidence is less than 1% of all ACL reconstructions and is most commonly superficial. Coagulase negative staph, like staph epidermidis, is the most common organism. Staph aureus is the second most common. Routine soaking of the graft intraoperatively in vancomycin solution may lower the risk of infection. Risk factors include graft contamination during routine intraoperative handling, as well as a graft that is dropped on the floor. In terms of the presentation of infection and septic arthritis, these patients may have pain, swelling, erythema, and an increased white blood cell count at 2 to 14 days post-op. The diagnosis is made with joint aspiration with a Gram stain and cultures. Treatment intraoperatively is routine soaking of the graft in various antibiotic solutions before placement, and know that sequential washing in various antibiotic solutions showed no increase in infection risk for dropped grafts. Postoperative treatment includes immediate arthroscopic IND, and know that you can often retain the graft with multiple INDs and antibiotics, with 6 weeks minimum. This is more likely to be successful with staph epidermidis and less likely with staph aureus. Moving on to loss of motion and arthrofibrosis, this is the most common complication following ACL reconstruction. Risk factors include lack of preoperative motion. The presentation involves loss of patellar translation. Treatments can include preoperative prevention, in which the patient has regained full range of motion before you operate, otherwise known as prehab. Also waiting until swelling or the inflammatory phase has gone down to reduce the incidence of arthrofibrosis. Operative prevention includes proper tunnel placement, which is critical to have full range of motion. Postoperative prevention includes aggressive cryotherapy with ice, and in the setting of loss of motion or arthrofibrosis at less than 12 weeks, you can do aggressive PT and serial splinting, while at greater than 3 weeks, you should do lysis of adhesion / manipulation under anesthesia. Moving on to infrapatellar contracture syndrome, as far as incidence, this is an uncommon complication which results in knee stiffness. Physical exam will show decreased patellar translation. Moving on to patellar tendon rupture, you will see patella alta on lateral radiograph. Another potential complication is reflex sympathetic dystrophy, otherwise known as complex regional pain syndrome. A patellar fracture is another potential complication, and a bone patellar tendon bone and a quadriceps graft with a bone block are implicated. Most fractures occur 8 to 12 weeks post-op. In terms of tunnel osteolysis, treatment is observation unless there's graft laxity and knee instability. Late osteoarthritis is related to meniscal integrity. Note that increased rates are noted in patients aged greater than 50 at the time of ACL reconstruction. Another potential complication is local nerve irritation, specifically the saphenous nerve, due to hamstring autograft harvest. Finally, a cyclops lesion is another potential complication, which is a fibroproliferative tissue that blocks extension. And in this setting, a click is heard at terminal extension. Finally, let's end this review session talking about prognosis. So as far as natural history, ACL-deficient knees are believed to lead to an accelerated progression of arthritis. And as far as survival with treatment, there is near complete restoration of native kinematics following reconstruction, and there is a high level of return to sport at all levels of competition. Okay, so now that we've gone over the major points about this topic, let's go over a few questions to apply the information and get a sense of how this topic has been tested on past exams. The first question reads, which of the following variables is a risk factor for graft failure following ACL reconstruction? And the choices are 1, concomitant MCL injury, 2, early accelerated rehabilitation protocol, 3, graft screw divergence of 35 degrees, 4, presence of a Sagan fracture of preoperative radiographs, and 5, tibial tunnel placement 10 millimeters in front of the anterior border of the PCL. The correct answer to this question is 3, graft screw divergence of 35 degrees. So graft screw divergence exceeding 30 degrees is a risk factor for ACL graft failure. Participation in early accelerated rehabilitation protocols does not have an increased risk of re-injury compared with non-accelerated rehabilitation programs. The most common cause of ACL failure is tunnel malposition. However, other causes of re-injury include inadequate graft fixation and missed concomitant posterolateral corner injuries. Graft screw divergence of greater than 30 degrees from the trajectory of the femoral tunnel may lead to failure of fixation and early ACL failure. Conversely, recent randomized clinical trials that compared early accelerated versus non-accelerated rehabilitation programs demonstrated no significant differences in function, re-injury, or return to play. Benin et al. Compared rehabilitation following ACL reconstruction with either an accelerated or non-accelerated program. An accelerated program was completed within 19 weeks compared to a 32-week non-accelerated program. They found that at the 2-year follow-up, the groups were similar in terms of clinical assessment, patient satisfaction, function, proprioception, and isokinetic thigh muscle strength. They concluded that rehabilitation with the accelerated and non-accelerated programs have the same clinical assessment, functional performance, proprioception, and thigh muscle strength, which returned to normal levels after healing was complete. Limos et al. Performed a biomechanical evaluation in 12 pairs of fresh intact bovine knees of femoral interference screws placed divergently and parallel relative to the bone block and its tunnel. They report failure was evident with divergent constructs. They concluded that pullout strength remains high, even with divergence of up to 15 degrees between the bone plug and femoral interference screws placed endoscopically. To quickly go over the incorrect answers, answer 1, MCL injuries are commonly associated with ACL ruptures. They do not pose a significant risk of re-injury. Answer 2, early accelerated rehabilitation protocols have been shown to be equivocal with non-accelerated programs with respect to re-injury. Answer 4, a Sagan fracture is an avulsion of the ALL. Many authors advocate for the repair of the ALL, but its presence has not been shown to be a significant risk factor for ACL re-injury. And finally, answer 5, tibial placement 10 millimeters in front of the anterior border of the PCL is incorrect, as this is normal positioning of the tibial tunnel in ACL reconstruction. Moving on to the next question. Anterior cruciate ligament or ACL graft failure is most commonly attributed to tunnel malposition. Which physical examination finding is correctly matched to the tunnel malposition? And the choices are 1, positive anterior drawer with a vertical femoral tunnel, 2, increased knee flexion with an anterior femoral tunnel, 3, inability to fully extend the knee with an anterior tibial tunnel, 4, positive pivot shift with an anterior tibial tunnel, and 5, increased anterior tibial translation and knee extension with a posterior femoral tunnel. The correct answer to this question is 3, inability to fully extend the knee with an anterior tibial tunnel. So if the tibial tunnel is placed too anteriorly, both knee extension and flexion will be limited, as the graft will impinge on the intercondylar notch in knee extension and be overly tight in knee flexion. To quickly review, tunnel malposition is the most common technical error resulting in an increased risk of graft failure in the postoperative period. Non-anatomic tunnel placement results in an anisometric graft. Tibial tunnel malposition occurs most often in the sagittal plane. The center of the tibial tunnel should be roughly 10 millimeters anterior to the PCL and in line with the posterior aspect of the anterior horn of the lateral meniscus. An anteriorly placed tibial tunnel leads to flexion tightness and inability to achieve full knee extension secondary to notch impingement. Conversely, a posteriorly placed tibial tunnel leads to impingement on the PCL in knee flexion. Battaglia et al. Explains that more than 75% of all cases of failed ACL reconstruction are secondary to technical error, most commonly attributed to malpositioned tunnels. The authors discuss that revision ACL reconstruction following failure secondary to malpositioned tunnels is often complicated by bony defects and tunnel osteolysis. Chabra et al. Reviewed the anatomy and biomechanics of the anteromedial and posterolateral bundles of the ACL. The authors conclude that the posterolateral bundle is tight chiefly in extension and contributes to rotational stability, while the anteromedial bundle becomes tight with flexion and contributes significantly to anteroposterior stability. As a result, the anteromedial bundle may be assessed with the anterior drawer, while the posterolateral bundle is assessed with the pivot shift. To quickly go over the incorrect answers, answer 1, a vertical femoral tunnel will lead to persistent rotational instability. Rotational stability is assessed with the pivot shift. Anteroposterior stability is assessed with an anterior drawer or Lachman and is unaffected by vertical femoral tunnel malposition. Answer 2, an anterior femoral tunnel will lead to a graft that is tight in knee flexion and loose in extension. As a result, knee flexion may be limited and increased anterior tibial translation may be appreciable in knee extension. Answer 4, anterior tibial tunnel placement will lead to limited knee flexion and extension due to excessive graft tightness in flexion and graft impingement on the intercondylar notch in extension. The pivot shift assesses for rotational instability, which may be seen with a vertical femoral tunnel. And finally, answer 5, a posterior femoral tunnel will result in limited knee extension and increased anterior tibial translation with the knee in flexion. And moving on to the final question, which of the following most predisposes female athletes to the development of a non-contact anterior cruciate ligament tear? And the choices are 1, higher hamstring activity relative to quadriceps activity, 2, landing with decreased hip and knee flexion, increased knee external rotation and dynamic valgus, 3, ovulatory phase of the menstrual cycle, 4, post-ovulatory phase of the menstrual cycle, and 5, decreased femoral notch width relative to males. The correct answer to this question is 2, landing with decreased hip and knee flexion, increased knee external rotation, and dynamic valgus. So different neuromuscular recruitment patterns like high quadriceps to hamstring activity ratio and landing slash cutting biomechanics like decreased hip and knee flexion, increased knee external rotation with subsequent dynamic knee valgus contribute most to the increased incidence of ACL tears in female athletes. To quickly review, ACL tears are 2 to 9 times more common in female athletes compared to their male counterparts. The difference in ACL injury rates is not seen until puberty. A variety of factors are postulated to play a role in this discrepancy, including smaller femoral notch size, smaller ACL, increased Q angle, and hormonal differences. Altered neuromuscular activation and movement coordination appear to be the most common reason for different ACL injury rates between the sexes. ACL prevention programs primarily aim to modify these maladaptive neuromuscular and biomechanical patterns. Griffin et al. Summarized the findings of the second Hunt Valley meeting, focusing on risk factors for ACL injury and current prevention programs. There is good evidence that neuromuscular training, including strengthening and flexibility exercises, plyometrics, agility and technique training, as well as a heightened awareness of the biomechanics of injury, reduces ACL injury risk in female athletes. Randomized trials are underway to determine the longitudinal effect of initiating prevention programs at an early age. The impact of ACL prevention programs is still largely unknown. Voskanian et al. Reviewed risk factors for ACL injury in female athletes and proposed key elements for a successful ACL prevention program. The authors recommend initiation of the prevention program prior to puberty, incorporation of neuromuscular training and muscle strengthening, as well as education and feedback regarding body biomechanics and proper landing patterns. Strengthening should focus on the hamstring and hip abductors, which may decrease dynamic knee valgus. Lastly, the program should be easy to follow and require minimal equipment and time commitment as to enhance compliance. Zebis et al. Evaluated the effects of implementing a prophylactic neuromuscular training program in female athletes. Neuromuscular activity of the lower extremity was analyzed with electromyography, or EMG, during performance of a side-cutting maneuver in 12 soccer players and 8 handball players, before and after implementation of a neuromuscular training program. Neuromuscular training increased the pre-landing and landing EMG activity for the medial hamstring muscles, while the quadriceps EMG activity remained unchanged. An increased ratio between hamstring and quadriceps activity may decrease the risk of dynamic knee valgus and subsequent ACL tear. To quickly go over the incorrect answers, answer 1, high quadriceps to hamstring activity ratio is associated with an increased risk of ACL injury, not high hamstring to quadriceps activity ratio. Aggressive quadriceps loading of the knee has been found in cadaveric studies to result in significant anterior translation of the tibia relative to the femur, and hence it has been proposed as a potential mechanism of injury. Answer 3, ovulatory phase of the menstrual cycle, and 4, post-ovulatory phase of the menstrual cycle are incorrect, as while the association between elevated estrogen and ACL injury has been suggested, there is no scientific consensus that hormonal variations in different stages of the menstrual cycle play a role in higher incidence of ACL injury in females, though research in this area is ongoing. Finally, answer 5, females do have smaller femoral notches compared to males, but this anatomic factor is far less significant than neuromuscular coordination. That's all for this review about ACL tears. Hopefully that was helpful. This is the OrthoBullets podcast, a daily audio review session by OrthoBullets, the free learning and collaboration community for orthopedic surgery education. Keep in mind that these podcasts are designed to go along with the topics on orthobullets.com, and in fact, you can listen to these episodes right on the OrthoBullets website or mobile app while going through the topic. If you've gotten any value from the OrthoBullets podcast so far, please consider leaving us a 5-star rating and writing us a review on Apple Podcasts. It will help us spread the word and increase our discoverability tremendously. Thanks so much, and we'll see you all tomorrow.